From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. Police departments throughout the country have been trying to take on a challenging demand, and that's to hold police accountable and improve their relationships with communities of color. A flood of departments have tried things like implicit bias training and community outreach. But our next guest says those efforts have largely been unsuccessful in weeding out racism among police officers. Jack Glazer is a social psychologist with UC Berkeley whose work focuses on police practices and implicit bias. And he joins us now to explain more on why those efforts haven't worked. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Tanya.
Your research from 2016 with other social scientists found that racial bias is deeply rooted within most police departments across the country. And really, efforts to retrain officers have been uneven and largely unsuccessful. How did you come to that conclusion?
Police officers, like everybody else, have implicit biases stored in their memories. In other words, they have associations between groups and traits, and one of which is the association between Black people and crime and weapons and violence. Those associations are stored in their memories, and they can cause them to regard somebody with more suspicion than they should because the person belongs to that group that is stereotyped that way. And as a result, because they are engaged in trying to assess who's involved in criminal activity all the time, they're particularly vulnerable to making the kinds of errors that these biases can cause.
Let's break that down a little bit more. I mean, because police bias against Black men in America is nothing new, but you actually argue that most officers are not like Derek Chauvin. They are the exception, not the norm. But back to what you were saying about making these split-second decisions based on these shortcuts in your brain, essentially, on what's good and what's bad. I mean, you found that when officers are put into a potentially violent situation, they often reacted in anger, as you're saying. Can you break that down on why that is a little bit more?
Well, I think it's clear that actually the primary motivation that officers experience in these use of force situations is fear. And fear or anger will cause the brain to function in a different way than you would in the absence of those emotions. And that means that the higher order functioning in the brain is going to be compromised, and you're going to be left with the more automatic processing and the more reflexive kind of responding that can give rise to aggressive responses or cognitive errors, like mistaking a cell phone for a gun, particularly if it's in the hand of somebody who you already have an automatic mental association between that person's race and weapons or crime or violence.
When you studied the protests over the summer in response to George Floyd's killing, you found that police officers reacted more violently against Black Lives Matter protesters than they have against armed right-wing groups. Many people also called out the somewhat passive response Capitol police officers took against Trump supporters at that insurrection back in January. So why, with all of the implicit bias training that we've been talking about over the last few years that many police departments have implemented, are officers still reacting more aggressively to people of color?
While the implicit bias training is well-intentioned and it's very widespread, the very nature of implicit bias is such that it's not something that you can intentionally control. It is inherently automatic and uncontrollable. And if you put somebody into a situation where they're distracted or fatigued or afraid or angry, it's going to be extremely difficult for them to be able to differentiate between the various cognitive influences on the judgments that they're making. We don't really know how at this point to, one, de-bias people, to remove their implicit biases because they're learned over many years and they're sort of designed to be resilient. And two, we don't even know how to teach people to employ strategies that will, in any lasting, long-term sort of way, help them to override the biases.
Is this the system change that many folks are talking about? Because it sounds really disheartening to hear that implicit bias training may not bring about the system changes that people are hoping for.
Yeah, I think that's right. Change needs to happen at the systemic level, and priorities of policing need to shift.
What about the calls to defund police? That includes reallocating funds away from policing and towards things like social services. Based on your research, could that help curb police violence better than some of these other measures?
I do think so. The idea that you would shift some funding from traditional law enforcement activities to other kinds of actors, particularly unarmed actors. There are ways to do that without eliminating police. The other side of that coin that I think people need to keep an eye on is that if all of the non-enforcement activities, if all of the non-crime fighting activities are taken away from police, there is the risk that there would be a psychological hardening of police where they are even more cynical than they currently are because everything they're doing is about fighting crime and about catching bad guys.
This is really just the beginning of this conversation. That's Jack Glaser, a social psychologist with UC Berkeley. Thank you so much for your time and parsing out your work for us.
Thank you, Tony.
Now to Colorado, which passed some of the most sweeping reforms to policing of any state in the country last year. Among the changes, putting an end to qualified immunity, the legal doctrine that protects officers from civil lawsuits. The Mountain West News Bureau's Robin Vincent explains how Colorado got it done so quickly.
We want justice!
Colorado Democratic State Legislator Leslie Harrod says the demonstrations over the death of George Floyd compelled lawmakers to move fast.
We had such pressure, not only from folks protesting outside of the state capitol in Denver, but from across the state to say that this is wrong. I don't care what side of the political spectrum you're on.
The Colorado legislature returned for a short session last spring amid America's reckoning on racism. That's when Harrod, who chairs the state's Black Democratic Caucus, helped craft a sweeping police reform bill.
We took it upon the state legislature to say that we are going to address this issue of police brutality, and we're going to do it now.
With the support of Democratic legislators, Harrod and co-sponsors brought Republican lawmakers and police lobbyists to the table, too, passing SB 217 during a whirlwind session. They did this in a state with the sixth highest rate of police killings in the nation. Justin Smith is Larimer County Sheriff. He, along with other police lobbyists, helped mold the bill as it moved through the legislature at a rapid pace.
And in a little over a 10-day period, we worked to write over 40 successful amendments.
They had to give up on some issues, like qualified immunity for police officers. That's the legal doctrine that protects police from civil lawsuits. The new Colorado law eliminates that protection for local police. But police representatives were able to put a $25,000 cap on the amount an officer can be sued for. Still, Smith remains concerned that police could be unfairly punished for doing their jobs. He says qualified immunity was not a free pass for officers.
The purpose of the qualified immunity was to recognize officers are responding to dynamic things. They're making life and death decisions at the drop of a hat.
The removal of qualified immunity, combined with the bill's other measures, caught the attention of criminal justice experts across the country.
There's no other state legislator in this country that has been able to do what Colorado has done to date. It just hadn't happened.
That's Howard Henderson. He heads the Center for Justice Research at Texas Southern University. He says Colorado is ground zero for police reform because the state's new law ticks multiple boxes.
Body-worn cameras, use of force, duty to intervene, firing police officers, qualified immunity, police prosecutions, protester protections, and data tracking all in one bill.
In Colorado, it wasn't only the death of George Floyd that galvanized protesters and forced lawmakers to act. Representative Leslie Harrod says it was also
the subsequent knowledge of Elijah McClain's death.
McClain's death was Colorado's to confront.
Say his name.
In August 2019, in Aurora, east of Denver, McClain was tackled, handcuffed, and injected with a powerful sedative after police received a call about a suspicious person. The 23-year-old Black man went into cardiac arrest and died a few days later. Aurora City Council authorized an independent review of the incident. The report, issued in February, was deeply critical of police and paramedics' actions that night. McClain's death helped spur legislative action statewide, as well as local reforms. Aurora Police Chief Vanessa Wilson was hired roughly a year after McClain died and quickly implemented changes like banning the type of chokehold officers used on McClain. Now, a community policing task force wants the power to fire officers. Wilson says she's open to that too.
We have to change and we have to evolve because that's what the community is asking for, not just the Aurora Police Department, but law enforcement in general.
Criminal justice expert Henderson says change at the local and state level is most impactful. That's where 85% of criminal justice happens. And the public appetite for such reform is growing.
Societal consensus changes over time on all manner of issues. Look, abortion, gay rights, policing is not excluded from that.
Henderson says law enforcement has been hesitant to change, but that no system of power maintains itself forever. For Here and Now, I'm Robin Vincent.
Just over a week ago, President Biden announced his plan to end the war in Afghanistan by September 11th, on the 20th anniversary of the attacks that led to the U.S. invasion in 2001. Top military officials say fighting terrorism will be more difficult when all U.S. forces are out of Afghanistan. General Kenneth McKenzie, head of U.S. Central Command, testified today before the Senate Armed Services Committee.
We will have an architecture in the theater that will allow us to look into Afghanistan. It will not give us the same picture that we've got now. It will allow us to see in. The ranges will be greater. The resources will be greater. The risks will all be greater.
Tom Bowman covers the Pentagon for NPR. Tom, welcome.
Hey, Peter.
There are about 2,500 U.S. troops in Afghanistan right now. We just heard General McKenzie say the risk will be greater when they're gone. Tell us more about the Pentagon's concerns here.
Well, the Taliban have not broken with al-Qaeda, as called for in the U.S.-Taliban agreement. The U.S. says al-Qaeda presence, Peter, is actually growing, so that's a huge concern. And the president said, listen, with al-Qaeda, it's been degraded, and with bin Laden dead, there's not the kind of threat you saw 20 years ago. So the Biden administration says any counterterror efforts will be done, quote, over the horizon, meaning from another country, perhaps to the north, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan. And the U.S. could continue to fly surveillance drones over Afghanistan to keep an eye on things. But here's the thing, Peter, without a presence on the ground, General McKenzie said making sure Afghanistan does not once again become a haven for terrorists will be difficult.
Hmm. What else did you hear in today's hearing that jumped out at you?
Well, the Taliban is still very strong. They estimate 50,000 members, and General McKenzie said with the U.S. soldiers and trainers gone, the U.S. will mentor Afghan forces from, what he said, a remote location. So we don't know how that will work. He also said, you know, the embassy could have a security cooperation office. You work with the Afghans like you see in other countries. But what if the violence increases or if there's a civil war? You could see the embassy reduce in size or even close.
Well, precisely. What if? I mean, do U.S. officials believe Afghan forces are ready to deal with the what if and with the Taliban on their own?
You know, not really. The rank and file soldiers are getting hit hard by the Taliban. Sometimes U.S. airstrikes have to come in to help them against the Taliban. So they're mounting casualties, desertions, poor leadership. Now, there's a commando force numbering anywhere from 20,000 to 30,000. They're quite good, but stretched thin. A big problem is maintaining the equipment, because when all the troops leave, thousands of civilian contractors leave with them. Those contractors, Peter, are vital for most, if not all, the maintenance of vehicles and aircraft. So when everyone leaves, that could all come quickly to an end, maybe in just a few months. No one is really talking enough about that maintenance.
I have just about 30 seconds here, Tom. There's also some concern I know about getting visas for those Afghans who worked for the American war effort over the years. What's going to happen to them?
Well, the State Department says a major priority now is to grant what's called special immigration visas to an estimated 11,000 to 17,000 Afghans who work for the Americans, mostly as translators. They, of course, could be targeted by the Taliban, so many are eager to get out, but that takes a long time getting those visas. Keep an eye on that.
Tom Bowman covers the Pentagon for NPR. Thanks very much for your insights.
You're welcome, Peter.
And what do veterans of the war think about all of this? Jason Dempsey is a retired Army officer who served two tours in Afghanistan. He's now with the Center for a New American Security. Jason, welcome back. Do you agree with military leaders and some lawmakers that pulling out too soon will be dangerous?
Staying in was dangerous and unproductive. Pulling out will also be dangerous. And that's the point missing in a lot of this, and the reason why it's been so hard for folks to pull out, because everybody wants to talk. Whenever there's any mention of withdrawal, everybody throws out this idea, well, we haven't made the conditions for withdrawal, so we can't. But then there's never a follow-up to say, well, how come we haven't been able to meet the conditions for withdrawal? What are we doing so inefficiently and at such an extravagant cost that we can't even seem to make any sustainable progress in Afghanistan? And to get more directly to your question, the reason this is going to be bad is because we've continued to prop up a security apparatus and an Afghan military for a nation that simply doesn't exist. What you've heard from all the generals when they talk about where and how the Afghan forces are successful or not, they are reinforcing the idea that all we have done is propped up a security force in our own image that is very, very ineffective without us. So there's going to be some resettling with the Afghan forces once we withdraw.
Well, in fact, you were an advisor to those forces during your second tour in 2012. It was nearly a decade ago now, but we're crazy. Still having these questions about whether those troops are ready to take over. Do you think that the U.S. training mission in Afghanistan just failed?
It absolutely did. Let's be very, very clear about that. It absolutely did. And the reason it failed was because we wanted to take the easy way out. And for all the talk of military leaders wanting long time horizons, every single time a new ISAF commander rotated in, he looked around, saw an exceptionally dysfunctional Afghan military, but said, you know what? It's not on me to address the root causes. So I'm just going to prop them up and take the fight to the Taliban to buy space for this force to develop, when in fact, there was no way it was ever going to develop. Because what we did was we took a country with very little bureaucratic infrastructure, very little experience with technology, a very uneducated population. And what we did was we tried to create a Western military. And we turned a nation of folks who definitely know how to fight. We gave them all these tools and gadgets and made them unable to fight without our support.
How do you think those Afghan forces, some of which you helped train, are feeling today as they look at the challenge ahead of them?
A lot of trepidation, but certainly they've been planning for it for a while. I will tell you that I and many other younger officers and military personnel rotating in, there's always a sense of insult when you'd run across an Afghan and you'd be like, man, I'm here for you. We want to work together as a team. We're going to go out. We're going to win this thing. And they'd be like, yeah, sure, sure. And you could always sense they're like, yeah, we've played this game before. You guys may or may not be with us for the long haul. And so there's always this dance. They held their organic power structures. They kept their tribal affiliations, the things that kept them alive through 40 years of war. And they're always hesitant to fully embrace where we were going. And so they're ready for it. But what's going to happen is the structure we have on paper, say, hey, the Afghan National Security Forces looks like this. It's going to fracture. That doesn't mean it's necessarily going to collapse, but it's going to fracture. People are going to seize control of weapons here and there. And it's going to take a little while for something more similar to what we saw circa pre-2001, where you had the Northern Alliance, you had cohorts of warlords. Something like that's going to settle out and face against the Taliban.
Did you lose any of the soldiers who served under you when you were deployed?
Primarily, yes, in 2009, when it was a much more direct fight, when we were on the east side of the Kunar River and south of Kabul and Wardak and Logar.
So when you think about those colleagues of yours, if the U.S. troops leave, when the U.S. troops leave, the Taliban comes in and fills the void potentially. Afghanistan becomes a place that is once again destabilized. Perhaps future terror attacks are hatched there. Will those losses be for naught? I mean, how do you grapple with that possibility?
Well, for one, I just hate the question, and it's nothing personal. The question sets us up for this idea that if an American soldier ever dies, then we have to double down on that effort. And basing policy on a sunk cost effort is never a way to create a coherent policy, particularly when we're talking about war. And without those deaths, the question would be, you know, I would turn that question around. Anybody say, well, hey, what? How can you not honor the dead by continuing this fight? I'd say, if those people hadn't died, would you be willing to endorse what we've been doing in Afghanistan for the last 5 years? Would you really think that that is within our capability to completely restructure a foreign government to something that we like and to completely build a military from scratch in our own image in a nation that cannot support that type of military? That's the real question about whether or not we should be there.
Have we learned anything in 20 years?
Personally, a lot more humility. And I hope that the lesson the American public and the American policymakers take out of this is the idea that there are limits to American power. Just because we say we want something and that we believe in something doesn't necessarily mean we can achieve it. And more importantly, given our current love affair with the military, there are absolute, very distinct limits to what we should ask the American military to do. And nation building is absolutely not one of the things that the American military is capable of.
Jason Dempsey served two tours in Afghanistan, now with the Center for a New American Security. Jason, thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
In stressful times, you want to spend your time checking out not just what's best, but what's best for you. We know you care about what you watch, what you read, and what you listen to. NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast is with you 5 days a week to make sure that time is well spent. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Millions of people lost their jobs and their regular paychecks during the pandemic. But so far, there's not been a huge surge in the number of people losing their housing. That's thanks in part to federal relief money and a moratorium on evictions. But plenty of renters are still ending up in eviction court. In this report that first aired on All Things Considered, Matt Bloom with member station KUNC in Boulder, Colorado, finds that a growing trend is to offer renters free legal help.
On the coffee table inside her living room, Christy DeFurio is sifting through a thick stack of paperwork. It's from earlier this year, when her landlord tried to evict her from her one-bedroom apartment for falling behind on rent.
So that's the demand for rent or possession, and I owe over $10,000.
At first, she got protection from the federal pandemic eviction moratorium. But when she got into a conflict with neighbors, her case landed in court. There, DeFurio, like most renters, didn't have a lawyer. She felt lost.
It's set up to be confusing, I think, on purpose, so that people, like the normal person, is confused and overwhelmed and intimidated.
To her surprise, though, the judge told her the city already had a lawyer to represent her for free. Last November, Boulder voters passed an initiative that provides a lawyer for every renter going through eviction. The so-called Right to Counsel program has already prevented dozens of evictions since launching earlier this year.
It's most common for individuals to come in to be scared, to feel overwhelmed, to have no idea what to do.
Tom Ward, an attorney with the program, advises tenants of their rights and helps them better negotiate deals with landlords.
So it's my goal to keep this from being an eviction from being on a tenant's record.
An important step because prior eviction can make it harder to rent in the future. Boulder has joined at least six other cities in giving all renters facing eviction the right to free legal help. San Francisco and New York City have done so for over 2 years. Emily Benfer is a law professor at Wake Forest University who specializes in housing issues.
Right to counsel is one of the most important and successful interventions that has an incredibly strong evidence base.
A study found that 84% of tenants in New York who got a lawyer were able to avoid eviction. Women in low-income communities of color benefited most. Benver says the pandemic has only increased interest in this type of resource for renters.
I think the heightened risk of eviction right now has certainly drawn attention to this crisis, and policymakers across the country are asking the question, how can we intervene?
Just this month, Maryland's state legislature approved right to counsel statewide. Bills are now pending in at least six other states, including Nebraska, Washington State, and Indiana. But Boulder landlord Tim Bent says somebody has to pay for the free attorneys. He owns more than 300 rental properties.
In my case, it's, I think, $35,000, $36,000 a year, which is a lot of money.
Boulder's lawyers are paid via an annual $75 per unit tax on landlords. He says many property owners pass along that cost to renters.
It makes it that much more difficult for tenants to afford to live here when they have to pay fees.
Other cities use general tax revenue instead of fees on landlords. Proposed legislation in other states would do that too, or tap COVID-19 stimulus dollars. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau estimates more than 8 million households are behind on rent. The federal moratorium on evictions due to the pandemic is set to expire June 30th. For NPR News, I'm Matt Bloom in Boulder.
Back in 2009, to the delight of pop-loving teens, a young new artist hit the scene. Justin Bieber, with his fresh face, swoopy hair, and soulful dance moves, stole the hearts and minds of young fans who were proud to call themselves part of Belieber Nation. Bieber rode on that success until around 2014, when he began to have several run-ins with the law. He later would go on to say he was struggling with mental health and drugs. Well, now the 27-year-old singer is back with his sixth studio album called Justice, an album that showcases a much more mature Justin Bieber. Take me as I am, swear I do the best I can, say I'm not going anywhere. The album chronicles the path of putting his life back together, and he spoke in depth about this with Zach Barron, a senior staff writer for GQ, who wrote about this in the May cover story, The Redemption of Justin Bieber. And Zach joins us now with more on the significance of this transformation. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
You met Justin, and within the first 10 minutes, the conversation kind of turns into what sounds like a confessional. He just talks and talks and talks, unprompted and motivated, what feels like to be an intense desire to share. And that actually felt significant to you. That's why you started your piece with it. Can you say more on why?
I think my expectations for Justin Bieber were, and I'm trying to find a kind way to say this, he's a child star. He's been famous for a long time. If you look at his history, he's not traditionally been the most self-reflective guy. He's not traditionally been super excited about the process of explaining himself to anyone else, whether it's a judge or a journalist. And instead, there was this sort of incredibly thoughtful, inquisitive, honest, gentle person. And as far as the piece went, I started there because I felt like that was the most honest place to start with. Like, I was expecting one guy and I got someone totally different.
Yeah, you were expecting someone more distracted, more unhappy, which really led you to how did you become this person. But let's go back a little bit. You know, throughout the early 2010s, Bieber dominated the headlines as this teeny bop star who had fallen from grace, so to speak. He was accused of punching a paparazzi and doing inappropriate things like writing What Would a Belieber Do in the Anne Frank House Museum guest book. In 2014, he was charged with drunken driving in Miami Beach. How did he describe this dark period in his life to you, and what fueled it?
I think what fueled it was self-loathing. I mean, this thing I say in the piece, which is like fame breaks your brain a little bit. This is a guy who became famous when he was around 13 years old. And subsequent to that, he's sort of in this system that values him for his talent, but mostly values him for the kind of money he can make. And everyone really treats him like a star and not like a 13-year-old or 14-year-old. And I don't think that's to excuse Anne Frank would have been a Belieber, you know, or urinating in a mop bucket. And I think it's to say that these are the things that happen when you get a lot of money and a lot of fame at a young age. Your brain's not ready for it, especially if you don't have a great support system around you, which Justin didn't. I think his parents love him, but they're both young. They're not together. They were not always able to be as supportive as he wanted.
The two things, though, that you write that brought Justin Bieber back ultimately is his marriage and his faith. What they had in common was that they were value systems that didn't depend on him performing in exchange for money, which, as you're saying, is so key because as a child star, your life is constantly dictated by your career and ultimately money. What insights did you learn about how those two things, marriage and faith, transformed him?
It's delicate to discuss. I think the adults in his life, whether they be his managers or his parents, publicist, bodyguard, you name it, it's not that they don't care for him, but it's that they all participate in this system that generates a ton of money and a ton of power, and they're incentivized to some extent to keep this machine going no matter what. Then he meets his now wife, Hailey Bieber, who was Hailey Baldwin then. And I think Hailey was one of the first people that he met that was like, hey, maybe don't go to work today. Maybe don't go on tour. Maybe don't stay up all night. That's their value. It's what it can do for you. It's what it can do for the two of us. It's not what it can do for another person. And I think faith was something similar in the sense of that's a system that says you have value. Doesn't matter who you are. And I think he had been around various churches and various pastors his whole life. But I think at some point he started really hearing that message.
I want to ask you about the evolving of Justin Bieber's fan base, because all of his fans from the 2000s and the 2010s are now fully grown into adulthood. It seems that Justin is moving along with his fan base. Does he see that? And what has he talked about regarding his relationship to them?
You know, he told me something really funny about working on this new record, which is that he 9-to-5'd it. And, you know, for you and I, that's like pretty normal. But it kind of dispels that myth of, man, you really have to suffer or act like a rock star to make these big pop albums. And I think it's a pretty good Justin Bieber record. And he was like kind of shocked that it worked, but it worked.
Well, there's a lot of buzz around Bieber's latest album, Justice, not just because it has some feel-good tracks, but also because it's quite honest to what you're talking about, and he's very vulnerable, as we hear in this song, Lonely.
Everybody knows my name now, but something about it still feels strange. Like looking in a mirror, trying to steady yourself and seeing somebody else.
You know, jumping off of this, what appears to be the start of Bieber's redemption was in 2017 when he canceled those final dates of his world tour. Can you talk more about his healing process and what he shared with you about that?
Yeah, so he tells this story about being on that tour that you just described, that it was a huge amount of money that he was walking away from. And he's in this castle in Ireland. He describes the hedges and how beautiful they are. And he's like, and I felt nothing. Not joy, not happiness, not even really sadness, just nothing. Total emptiness. And kind of goes on this journey of doing what a lot of us have to do as people, especially when we're teenagers, although this happened in his 20s, which is like, who am I? What do I like? What do I value? And if you're just like a rock star on the road when you're 15, those questions are just held at bay infinitely. And when they sneak up on you, you know, you don't necessarily go sulk in the corner like it's high school. You do drugs with your friends. You go out and party. So I think that he finally hit a point where he was like, I have to stop doing all that stuff. And I have to start kind of putting together a human being that isn't just this guy who goes on stage and performs for 30,000 people every night. I think that's cool. I think there are a lot of people who have been through what he's been through who never took that final step. And I was surprised, frankly, that he did, because as you mentioned earlier, he went through a lot and it definitely seemed like at times that was going to be who he was.
Well, Zach, that's the thing about this story, because we've seen this play out so many times with young stars who then burn out. And we see exactly what you're laying out here happen. Is that the takeaway from the evolution of Bieber here? I mean, whether you're a Bieber fan or not, he's relatable. It's kind of admirable and inspiring. Americans love a good comeback story. I mean, is this the big takeaway in examining Bieber's evolution?
Well, it's one thing I say in the piece, which is like, I think there's something very instinctive in our culture that says, okay, well, you have fame and you have money, so you don't deserve my sympathy. And like, fair enough. But I think we can all sort of empathize with like waking up one day and being like, hey, I don't really like the person I've become. And we can certainly empathize with that journey of like, okay, what will I have to do to become someone that I actually like? That work is hard. A lot of people never do it. He did. Now, he's 27 years old. There are a lot of chapters in this story left unwritten. Part of doing journalism like this is you're taking a snapshot of a moment. The guy who was in front of me, lovely guy, in a really good place. We can cross our fingers that that's him at 30 or 35, but he is in a wild, tough world and is sort of running without a bunch of the tools that the rest of us had to develop, and we'll see.
Zach Barron is a senior staff writer for GQ who wrote the May issue cover story, The Redemption of Justin Bieber, and we'll link you to that story at hereandnow.org. Thank you so much, Zach.
Thank you.
Many college-age students are going to need a coronavirus vaccine if they plan to return to campus in the fall. A growing number of universities are making them mandatory, including Northeastern University in Boston. Mike Armini is a senior VP at Northeastern and co-chair of the university's COVID-19 task force. Mike, welcome. Was this a tough decision to make? Did you lose any sleep over it?
I don't think it was a tough decision. We've had to make a lot of tough decisions over the past 14 months. The main reason, as you can imagine, is that students on a college campus, you know, live together. They eat their meals together. They're engaged in sports and other activities together. And it's what's called a congregate setting. And we think for that particular group, requiring vaccine is the right way to go. And it's what's going to allow us to have a normal semester next fall.
A couple nuts and bolts questions here. How will students prove that they've been vaccinated? And will you help them get vaccinated if they come to campus and they don't have one?
So obviously, most universities have already required vaccinations for many other diseases, whether it's measles or meningitis. And so there's already a process in place where students would either sort of sign an attestation or essentially upload proof of vaccination on a website. So either one of those methods will be used. As to your second question, we think our American students will have ready access to the vaccine throughout the summer. This requirement doesn't go into effect until the fall. We are very focused, however, on international students, and we have a very substantial percentage of students who are international who may have more difficult access to vaccine depending on the country they're coming from. So for some of those students, we may have to, you know, essentially vaccinate them upon arrival in September.
All right. We know a certain number of Americans do not want to get this vaccine, either for political or personal reasons. And even in a progressive city like Boston, I'm sure you're going to get some pushback on this idea. How much do you expect, and how much have you gotten already?
Well, let me be clear that if a student has a legitimate religious or medical reason to not be vaccinated, you know, we'll respect that. But it is important to know that these vaccines have undergone extensive clinical trials. They have been approved by the FDA for emergency use. That's very important. We realize that emergency use is not the same as a sort of full FDA approval like you might see for a flu vaccine. We're still in an emergency. So we think the case is very strong. We have had a very small amount of pushback, but you know, our role is to work with those students, try to have them understand the upside here. One of the most compelling arguments to make with students is that they all want to have a normal school year next year. And the way to do that is to enforce this requirement and have everybody come back vaccinated and then return to as close to a pre-COVID college experience as we can possibly provide.
I hear your argument, but also the people who might be hesitant to take this vaccine or don't want to take it also know that it's been approved by the government. They also know, for the most part, that it's safe to take. So what are you going to do if you have a student who comes up to campus and their family says, no, we're not going to do it?
Well, we hope it doesn't come to that. And one of the things that has helped with vaccine hesitancy around the country is essentially peer-to-peer inputs. I do think when students want to be here and when their friends and classmates and dorm mates are getting vaccinated, that should help. I suppose if there were a student and or some parents who were just dug in on that, we could look at a temporary leave of absence, take a semester off. We don't want to lose a student, but we also, you know, this is a requirement.
You're requiring students to get this shot, but I, as far as I understand, it's not a requirement yet for your faculty and staff. Why is that? Why not go all the way here?
It's a great question, and certainly we've looked at it. There are a few differences, though. The faculty and staff don't all live together and don't all eat meals together like the students do. As you can imagine, it does present a separate set of legal questions. Employment law is different.
Do you think you have the legal right to do that?
It's not clear that we do with the faculty and staff. With the students, we feel very confident that the requirement is consistent with current law.
If you reach this goal of getting all of your students vaccinated or the vast majority of them, what will the fall semester look like? Do you think you're going to show up to a campus in September that looks pre-pandemic?
That's the goal. We want to have students learning in classrooms, faculty members teaching in classrooms. We want to see a return to all of our fall athletics. We want all of our clubs to be happening, a cappella groups singing together, Model UN teams getting ready for competitions at other schools. And so the goal is to get back to that.
Mike Armini is a senior vice president at Northeastern University in Boston, which is requiring all of its students to get vaccinated before coming back to school in the fall. Mike, thanks very much.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And tomorrow we'll hear from the president of Dickinson State University in North Dakota. They're taking the opposite approach. They are not requiring students to get vaccinated. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.